From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Jaron Lanier is a computer scientist, a pioneer in virtual reality. In recent years, he's become more and more skeptical. He's criticized what he calls digital Maoism. His first book was You Are Not a Gadget, a Manifesto. And in his new book, he asks, who owns the future? He says digital networks have decimated the middle class, and he proposes an entirely different kind of economy. Jaron Lanier has founded startups that became part of major companies. He's created video games, released a major label record, and played music around the world, and he currently works with Microsoft Research. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
I am delighted to be here.
You have conceded you are complicit as a gifted technologist. You helped to formulate some of the ideas that you are now criticizing. Like what?
Well, it's very true. The biggest mistake we made, in my opinion, is the information wants to be free thing, the open source, open culture idea, which I was a huge proponent of from decades ago and helped articulate, I think. And the mistake is a very simple one. Throughout history, you see the creepiest people, the dictators and whatnot, trying to control information and trying to suppress the speech of others. So it's natural to say if we can use technology to make speech really, really open and unsuppressible, that should defeat the tendency of people to want to get creepy and control each other, right? Mm-hmm. To put it in the simplest terms. But the mistake we made is that if you have a bunch of people on an open network sharing information, and some of them have much better and more effective and bigger computers than the others, then those people with the big computers will have a huge advantage because they'll be able to take that same information that everybody else theoretically has access to and do so much more with that information that they can make themselves super powerful.
Did this change in belief about the information is free manifesto kind of come like a blinding flash, or did it come gradually to you?
It came to me around the turn of the century, but became graver in the course of the first decade of the century. And what happened is the first industry to be really hit by this idea was music. And of course, journalism is another one, as you're probably aware. And since I was also a professional musician, I saw firsthand what was happening. And what I had expected was to see musicians adapt and learn how to use the new techniques to create their careers in new ways. What I saw instead was only a tiny token number of people succeed at that, creating false hopes for everybody else, that statistically everyone was actually failing, even really clever, devoted people who ought to have been able to succeed. So I just saw it fail. But what really got to me was the recession, because what I saw was that the same architecture that we'd been promoting, and this gets a little technical, but the way finance has been networked is the same way that social networking and search have worked, where the people who aggregate the information and use it to calculate an advantage for themselves don't have to pay for it. And what I saw is that in finance, that was completely running out of control and was creating not only recessions, but a decline in the middle class and a decline in social mobility. And I realized that the advantage given to the people with the best computers, the kind of wealth concentration, was totally undoing everything I'd always worked towards. And it upset me greatly, and I realized I had to start talking about it.
Well, you talk about digital networks decimating the middle class, but what about those who have become middle class or even done better because of the digital revolution?
Well, there are very few of those. They're only token numbers. This is what we call a Horatio Alger story. Now, decimates your term, not mine, but it means 1 out of 10, and right. I'm sure we're worse than that, so it's probably accurate. So let me take you back to the 70s and 80s. In the personal computer revolution, we actually did build up the middle class, and the reason we did is people got to own their own data if they owned their own computer. And, you know, it's a very simple thing. But if you bought a computer, you own the data in it, and then you could build up your own little service. You could build your own little business. Now what happens is we give the computing away for free in order to own the data so that we can build behavioral models on people in order to manipulate them. So what's happening is people aren't getting that same advantage of getting to own their own data. They think they are, because what they get are what we call informal benefits at first. So, but what you get is you get an ability to promote yourself. You get what you get. There's this sort of scam. It's a sort of a confidence game where you say, oh, you're getting to save money because you're using the network. But of course, that's just artificial marketing. I mean, the price is just what it is. There's no such thing as saving, you know. But at any rate, what's happening is we're gradually reducing prospects for people, and they do get free treats or cheap treats up front in order to enter into the system. But what I realize is that if you crack open any of the new concentrations of power, what the Occupy movement calls the 1%, you'll find a big computer there. You won't find an oil field these days. You'll find a big computer.
And you give a specific example of Kodak and the way they had employees versus Instagram. Could you expand on that?
Well, sure. I mean, Kodak's an interesting example. So Kodak directly employed almost 150,000 people, not just with jobs, but with good middle class jobs with security and benefits, which is really different from a McJob. And it's important to keep that in mind. Instagram, which kind of offers a comparable service, you know, the way that people share their photos and create them in cool colors and all that stuff. I think it was 13 people and it sold for $1 billion. So you have this, and Kodak's bankrupt, of course. So you have this remarkable difference between, a huge middle-class employment base and this tiny, tiny elite really benefiting. And so this idea, well, everybody else benefits too because Instagram is free to use, misses the point. The point is that very gradually those people are losing their future job prospects in order to get free Instagram now. And there's just no way around that calculus. I mean, it's something we have to face up to.
But I'm talking to Jaron Lanier, and his new book is called Who Owns the Future. A lot of buggy whip manufacturers got put out of business, but the technology just kind of went around them and left them behind. And I'm wondering if that applies more to the Kodak case.
Sure. And the buggy whip industry was big in Rochester, where Kodak was. So let's talk about buggy whips. So 19th century saw a huge wave of anxiety about the future, about this question of whether people would still be employed when machines got better. That's the Luddite riots are 19th century. The Marxism is 19th century. The dawn of science fiction, which is all about whether people will become obsolete, is 19th century. Many other examples. So here's the interesting thing. You make buggy whips obsolete and you have motor vehicles. Operating a motor vehicle is much easier than dealing with horses. Now, I love horses. Don't get me wrong. Horses are lovely creatures. But the thing is, to have to deal with them on a day-to-day basis is really hard because you have to deal with their hooves and feeding them and the poop. And so, I mean, it's a big deal. It's really hard to deal with horses on an ongoing basis. So in contrast, driving a motor vehicle is incredibly fun and easy. People pay to get nice cars. People, you know, it's like this thing you'll pay to do. So there's this interesting question. Why in the world would you pay somebody to drive a cab or drive a truck when it's so much easier than dealing with horses? And the labor movement had to get really tough and nasty to answer that question in a certain way. And the way you answer the question is you say, you know, when technology makes life better, that should mean there are jobs that are more dignified and less dangerous and less dirty and less smelly than the old jobs. It shouldn't mean there are fewer jobs. So that the 20th century was solved because the labor movement answered that question. And what we've done in the 21st century is we've said, nah, let's just not pay them because, you know, computers make things easy. So it's too easy now. Now it's time to stop paying people. That we've essentially undone a covenant that saved our butts.
Well, part of what your argument here is that you've got a different vision for an economic future where this might be able to be addressed. And it has to do with the fact that we all are sharing information. Excuse me. And correct me if I'm misstating this, but you think there should be a way we should be able to participate and actually be rewarded for what we're sharing rather than have just Facebook and Google make all the money off this information.
Yeah. Well, see, right now the idea is that whoever has the biggest computer gets the formal benefits, and we all are supposed to get informal benefits like increased publicity opportunities or that kind of stuff. And informal benefits are what you have in developing economies. Formal benefits are what you have when you have a middle class, and you can afford to get sick once in a while. You can have kids. You can plan for old age. You know, so it's not that there are no benefits in the system we've been promoting. It's just that there are informal benefits that don't acknowledge the needs of the human life cycle. And then it's important to understand that I'm not just talking about the Googles, and let's be fair, it's also Bing, you know, or we wish anyway. I can say to my
reference
friends,
to your Microsoft employers.
Well, I figure it's a Seattle station. It's like our slogan should be, we want to be evil, please. But anyway, So the thing is, what's going on right now is all the big computers that have different surface appearances are fundamentally playing the same game. So it's not really about Google and Facebook. It's also about financial schemes in particular, but also national intelligence agencies, also insurance companies, also national elections. What's happening is all the centers of power, all of the big influential organizations are centering themselves around big computers. And the way it works is as follows. You gather information without having to pay for it. Sometimes it's voluntarily shared. Sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it comes from cameras that people where people don't know they're being observed. Sometimes they voluntarily entered your thing. And it doesn't matter. And then what you do is you analyze the data in order to perform statistical analysis way beyond the capability of anybody with normal computers and normal net access. And then you use that to perfect some scheme so that you don't take risks and everybody else takes your risks. And then you just wait and gradually become super hyper rich and powerful and the rest of the society pays for it. So just to give you a canonical example.
Sure.
I'd like to give you two examples that are very different. Actually, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
One of them is insurance. So if you, in the old days, if you're an insurance company, you hire these very nice statisticians, you call them actuaries, and they gather a little bit of data, but it's not personal data about each individual person, and they help you set rates. Now you can gather tons of data and create correlations to predict individual people, and you can't possibly resist the temptation to turn that into an attempt to make a perfect insurance company where you only insure the people who are least likely to need insurance. And that's the story of American healthcare. So the problem with American healthcare is largely an artifact of just having good computers, you know, and that's a sad thing. But it's totally fixable if you pay for information. And there's actually an easy fix. Well, not an easy fix, but there's a ready fix, let's say.
Well, when you say pay for information, pay us for our information,
well, look,
in a way.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm advocating is not a few little micropayment schemes here and there within company stores. I'm talking about a universal micropayment system as a right of citizenship. I think that if we had universal micropayments for data, when that data turns out to be of use, when it's referred to, when it's used, and that data could be anything. It could be recognizing you on a street corner or a line of code you wrote being run. There are all kinds of interesting ways this could work out. But the point is, if we do that, what could happen is something just amazing, which is a rise of a middle class that happens organically because of people learning to do things that are more useful for each other instead of through this sort of ad hoc basis, which the union movement created to solve the problem in the 20th century. That's the amazing possible outcome we could have.
You mentioned we would get paid for our information should it turn out to be useful. Is the information that we all turn out going to be useful, or would there be some people who just would not turn out useful information, so they would not get the benefits?
Yeah, well, I run into that question a lot. A lot of people are sort of skeptical that there would be a broad usefulness in what people would offer over networks, and I simply reject that elitism, not only because I think it does betray a kind of a chauvinism on the part of high-performing people or something towards everyone else, but also because it's just not borne out by the facts. For instance, if you look at how people are exposed to each other's data on a hub and spoke network, like an Apple Store or YouTube or something like that, you do see what we call this power law distribution of a small number of top stars, and then it falls off to what we call an emaciated long tail very rapidly. So you have a few winners and tons of wannabes. But if you look at how people receive each other's data on a thickly connected network, like a Facebook where everybody can talk to everybody, then you see people being exposed to a wide range of other people, and you see a distribution that actually would lead to something that looks like a middle class if there were micropayments flowing around. And that's where the magic is. That's why this is really worth pursuing.
You mentioned this as a citizenship right, and it's governments that convey benefits to citizens and rights to citizens. Does this kind of require some kind of well, it'd have to go maybe not just the United States government. It'd have to be all world governments would have to participate.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of ways that that could be sorted out. And that in the book, I explicitly say, I think, you know, I could present a solution to the national international thing and write it down. But I think it would just be ridiculous because I can't address that sort of thing this early. You know, there's a meta point that is really critical, which is that this has to be approached empirically, experimentally and incrementally. You know, you can't come at this the way Marx came at his ideas and say, I have the perfect solution, I know what the perfect society is, I know how to get there, and then have people sign up for it without any incremental testing and without any gradual approach, because that leads to disaster. So I not that I think anybody's treating me as somebody to follow at this point, but what I don't want to even risk suggesting that I know the answers in advance or that anybody possibly could. I think what we have to do is approach this as scientists and engineers and very gradually do tests. And there's some great opportunities to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's what gets us there, not perfect foreknowledge.
Does it become a zero-sum game, though, to the degree to which the value is shared, the people at Google, the people at Microsoft, the people at Facebook lose value?
No. If it did, then the whole idea of markets wouldn't work. The point of markets is that markets grow. So the idea is that when people coordinate well with each other, they don't just redistribute from a fixed pie. Because they're coordinating well with each other, they're creating more value than would have been there otherwise. So the idea is that an information market would actually be a growing market. So it would actually be better. I'm convinced it would be better for the big players. I mean, I'm convinced that we're shooting ourselves in the feet right now. For instance, look at Google and Facebook. You have these two companies with totally different competencies, different technologies, different cultures, and yet they're forced to compete head-to-head for the same small pool of advertisers, so-called advertisers. I don't even like the term for that. But even that isn't stable, because every time something gets more automated, like let's say right now there's somebody who's selling little plastic trinkets and they buy an ad from Google or Facebook. Eventually, 3D printers put them out of business because those things are shared over the Napster of 3D printing, whatever it'll be called. And so even that, you know, as technology progresses, that pool of people who are buying ads for whatever hasn't been made free yet is shrinking. And there's a pathetic quality about it. Why should these two companies even be in the same business when they do totally different things? In an expanding economy, see, what we're doing right now is we're actually shrinking the economy to build our fortunes. If we're building our fortunes by expanding the economy, then then that's really a win-win. That's a non-zero-sum game, and that's where we need to be.
And what are our digital overlords at Microsoft and Google and Facebook think about this? You know some of these folks.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think they're a little startled when I talk like this. But the thing is, I haven't lost my meal card because I have tech cred. So they have – I mean, they'll talk to me. I don't know exactly what they all think. I've privately heard remarkably supportive comments, not just from the Microsoft people, but from my friends at Google and Facebook too. And I feel close to Google. I mean, they bought a startup, you know, of mine, and they a lot of them are friends, and I've known them from before it was Google. And, you know, I think we have the best-natured elite in history in the tech community. I don't know if I can say that about the advanced finance community. That's a little different. But in the tech community, we have an open-minded, well-intended elite, and we have to take advantage of that moment.
Who owns the future? Well, we all can own the future. That's Jaron Lanier's new book, where he paints a new picture of how the economy could evolve to have us all benefit from the digital technologies. Thank you so much for talking about it. I really appreciate it.
Oh, sure. I'm delighted to be on.
As well as being a computer scientist and author, Jaron Lanier is also a musician. He maintains one of the largest and most varied instrument collections of actively played rare instruments in the world. He even plays some of his own handmade instruments. After our interview, he played a few bars on what he calls a handmade harmonica. It's almost 4 feet tall. Jaron Lanier on his handmade harmonica.